Good morning, Summit Church, and good to see all of you at all of our campus locations in the Triangle here. Let me begin this morning by addressing what is in your hand here or what is crinkling there beneath your seat, if you are still sitting on it. This is for our younger members. This is called a newspaper. This is how we used to exchange information back in the dark ages. Multiply is the name of a two-year initiative that we've been on, a journey we've been on together. We have focused all of our generosity into one fund called Multiply. We've always said that our primary goal in Multiply is not a financial goal, trying to reach some kind of financial measure. It is to see 100% of our people that are engaged in the mission of God through sacrificial giving and through serving. Well, that newspaper that you're holding in your hand is the record, or at least filled with some of the stories of how God has multiplied us as we have offered ourselves to Him for the last couple of years. You know, Summit Church, when you step back and you think about it, which is what we want to do from time to time, what we're seeing God do here through us is really nothing short of remarkable. Glory be to Him. For example, get this. You have probably heard us say that 228 of our members live overseas. Well, you know, we have them keep track of what they're doing and turning little reports to us. And those 228 members shared the gospel, get this, more than 10,000 individual times last year. I want you to think about that for a minute. These Summit members live in some of the most unreached places in the world, and thanks to your generosity, the gospel of Jesus was preached over 10,000 individual times. That has resulted in 42 new churches that have been planted internationally as a result of your generosity and your faith. Or you have heard us say that we want to plant 1,000 churches in our generation. Well, a new focus on that goal is we want to, by God's grace, plant 12 churches in the next 12 years in the most significant college towns in America, starting with our ACC schools. So we've got one going out this year to Charlottesville to plant a church right there at UVA, Clemson, Notre Dame, and Florida State. We are coming for you. So that is part of what we God has given us to do. In addition to all this, your generosity helps us continue to grow here in the Triangle. We now average more than 11,000 each weekend here in the Triangle at the Summit Church. We baptized 1,258 since Multiply started a couple of years ago. And in the new year, we're going to begin construction on a new 1,800-seat facility off of Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh. That is what we are celebrating, but the focus of this newspaper is not really reporting numbers to you. In fact, you're not going to find a lot of numbers in there. What you're going to see, what you're going to encounter are some stories, some individual stories that'll give you just a little bit of a taste of how God is at work multiplying you. I want to share one of them that's in there really quickly, or at least the Cliff Notes version of it, because it is just too good. One of our members that we sent to Central Asia a few years ago wrote us about the turn of the year and said that said he wanted to tell us a story that happened over Christmas, because at Christmas he had been invited by some local village leaders of a village in the mountain in the middle of this unreached people group who wanted him to come and spend some time with them. They were eating lunch together, he said, and since it was around Christmas time, when the conversation turned to religious things, he shared the gospel story with them, shared the Christmas story. And he said, I was really excited because I'd been praying about a chance to do that. He said, while I was sharing the Christmas story, they very politely listened. And he said, when I got done, they said to me, they said, and I quote, "Yes, yes, yes, we already know this story. And we already believe it. We asked you here today because we want to know, now that we believe it, what are we supposed to do now?" And our missionary said, "Well, I'm confused. What do you mean?" They explained that a couple of years before, somebody else had come and shared the story with them and left them some Bibles. The village leader said that they had gathered each night for several nights to read the Bibles, and as they read them, they realized that they believed the story that was written in it. They wanted to know if our missionary could help them now that they believed with whatever came next after belief. Our missionary, your Summit member missionary, said, "How many people are we talking about?" Thinking it would be like a couple of dozen people in this group. They said, "Oh, there's about 200 of us." Our missionary writes, he said, "Well, this is church planting made easy." He said, "You know, people like me should not get to see this. I get to see the birth of a church in a new people group. What did I do to deserve that? How could I possibly be qualified to be a part of this?" He says, "I can just imagine the conversation around the throne of God. Really, Lord? You want him there? Do you think that is going to work?" one of the angels asked. And God answers, well, yep, his language is frankly subpar. He isn't exactly good at the work in general, and he wasn't even that impressive in America. But he's there. Besides, nobody on earth is going to think he had anything to do with this, and so this is just how I roll. All right? Summit, your generosity made that story and many more like it possible. It's like 2 Corinthians says, God has enriched us in every way to be generous in every way, and through us it is producing thanksgiving to God in places like this village in the remote mountains of an unreached people group in Central Asia. So Summit Church, I want to thank you for your continued generosity and for never ceasing to pursue this great mission of ours to take the gospel to our neighbors and then from there to the nation. Could we put our hands together at all of our campuses and just celebrate the good things that God has done. I hope that you'll take some time over the next few days and just with your family, read some of these stories that are in there and just rejoice and be excited about how God has fulfilled his word and how he has multiplied us as we have asked him to. Okay, well, if you got your Bibles this weekend, I want you to take them out now and open them to the book of Esther. The book of Esther, you say, where is the book of Esther? It's in the Old Testament. It is right after the book of Nehemiah and right before the book of Job. It's on page 410 of my Bible, if that helps you at all. Esther is one of only two books in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that is named for a woman. And believe it or not, it is a pretty controversial book. It's not controversial because it was named for a woman. It is controversial because God's name is not mentioned in the book of Esther, not one single time. Not one time in the entire book from cover to cover will you find the name of God even mentioned. He's not prayed to in the book of Esther. And so there have been, throughout history, there have been Jewish councils and Christian councils that have tried to remove the book, have the book removed from the official canon of the Bible. Thankfully, however, God has seen fit to keep it in there for us because it's got something really important to teach us, I believe. And the fact that God's name is not mentioned in the book is part of the way that God teaches that to us, as I hope to demonstrate to you today. So it's not accidental that his name is not mentioned in there. I'm going to zero in on a specific moment in Esther's life that I believe parallels where we are as a church and also where many of you are as individuals. That moment that I'm going to zero in on occurs in chapter 4, but in order to get there, I need to give you some of the backstory. So we're going to walk through chapters 1 through 3 and then show you what happens after chapter 4, and then we'll kind of zero in on that moment in chapter 4. Okay? All right, so Esther chapter 1. Esther's story begins circa 483 BC or so. Esther is part of a large Jewish community that has remained in Persia, this modern day Iran, where God had sent Israel into exile about 100 years prior to this because Israel would not obey God. Well, most of the Jews have already gone back home to Israel from Persia because in 536 BC, which is about 50 years or so before the story of Esther, in 536 BC, a Persian king named Cyrus had issued an edict declaring that the Jews could return to their homeland and rebuild the temple. And so a large group of Jews, the majority, returned to the land under the leadership of a guy named Ezra and then another one named Nehemiah, whose books occur right before Esther in your Bible. But there was a large group of Jewish people that remained in Persia, and they did not follow Ezra and Nehemiah back to the Promised Land. In fact, they were sometimes looked down on by the Jews who did return because the Jews who did return to the Promised Land thought, well, these Jews just don't have enough faith and they've gotten too comfortable in captivity and they're living in disobedience. And so Esther is one of those who remained there in the land in Persia even after God had given them permission to go back. You guys with me so far? Esther is an orphan girl who is being raised by her older cousin Mordecai. The story of Esther begins chapter 1 with a king named Ahasuerus doing what kings do best, and that is throwing an enormous party for himself. Check it out. Esther chapter 1. And Ahasuerus displayed the glorious wealth of his kingdom and the magnificent splendor of his greatness for a total of 180 days. Yes, you read that correctly. He threw a 6-month party for himself. And then after the 6-month party was over, the real party began. At the end of this time, the king held another week-long banquet in the garden courtyard of the royal palace for all the people from the greatest to the least. Verse 8 describes the party to you. The drinking was according to royal decree. There are no restrictions. This was an all-inclusive party, and the king's command was, you need to drink a lot. Verse 10, on the seventh day, when the king was feeling good from the wine, which is a Hebrew way of saying he was stone cold plastered. Verse 11, King Ahasuerus commanded his eunuchs to go bring Queen Vashti before him with her royal crown because he wanted to show off her beauty. Verse 11 says, to his officials. The implication being he wanted her to come out wearing only her royal crown on her head so that all of his drunken guy friends could gaze on her beauty. Well, not surprisingly, Queen Vashti is not excited about this at all, and so she refuses, and good for her. But this embarrasses the king in front of his buddies, and so he goes back into his bedroom and starts sulking, and one of his wise guys comes to him, one of his wise men, and says, King, bro, this is serious. You got to do something about this, and not just for your sake, King. You got to do something for the sake of all men everywhere. In fact, this might be my favorite verse in all of Esther. He says, if you don't take this seriously, before this day is out, the wife of every one of us will hear what the queen did and will start talking to their husbands in the same way. There will be no end to the contempt and the anger throughout your realm, King. If when we command our wives to come out naked in front of our drunk buddies, she won't do it. What's this kingdom going to come to? Lawlessness, I say, anarchy. So Vashti gets kicked to the curb, but now Ahasuerus needs a new queen. So Ahasuerus comes up with a brilliant idea, he thinks. Chapter 2. Let us search the empire to find beautiful young virgins for the king. Then the young woman who pleases you most will be made queen instead of Vashti. In other words, he holds a nationwide contest eerily similar to The Bachelor. And here is how the contest worked. Contestants were put into the king's harem, and the king would try them out. Each night, a different one would appear before him. They would answer some questions. I guess they would do some kind of talent. And then that night, the king would sleep with them. After it was all over, the king would choose his favorite, and she would be the queen. Now, that probably sounds to you like a contest that a nice girl would not enter, and I agree, but I'm not sure whether Esther had much choice in the matter at all. In fact, the text makes clear that she was chosen to be in this contest. That's in verse 8, which means I'm not really sure she could have refused. It is probably more accurate to think of Esther as a sex slave, a victim of a cruel and exploitive man in power. On the other hand, there doesn't appear to be a lot of opposition to this on her or her family's part. You really don't find in this story any kind of, you know, Daniel in the lion's den or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace kind of defiant opposition or courageous protest where they say, no, we're going to obey God no matter what the cost. That is just absent from this story. In fact, chapter 2, verse 20 says that her family concealed the fact that she was Jewish, which also meant that she was totally silent about her belief in God. Because talking about her belief in Jehovah, in Yahweh, would have indicated that she was a Jew. And so she kept her mouth shut about that. Plus, the fact that Esther and Mordecai, who is the cousin who raised her, are both still in Persia several generations after Cyrus has given permission for the Jews to return to the promised land, is supposed to raise in you suspicion about their walk with God as you start the book. Why haven't they gone back to the promised land? Maybe most importantly, like I told you, God's name is not in this book, not one time, which is an indication that God is likely not the first and foremost thing in their minds. All this to say, these are not really exemplary people of faith, I would say, and this is a really messy situation. Now, let's get back to the story. The good news is Esther wins the contest. Chapter 2, verse 7 explains why she won the contest. Esther had a beautiful figure, and she was lovely to look at. In Hebrew, the literal word is bodacious. She was something else. She was a knockout. One final detail before we get into chapter 3. The author tells us really quickly about a man named Mordecai, who again was Esther's older cousin, and he essentially adopts her when her parents are killed. Now, Mordecai works near the palace, and he stumbles onto a plot to assassinate King Ahasuerus. He foils the plot, and he saves the king's life. But the king never finds out about it. That's an important detail we'll come back to later. Now, chapter 3 is where the story really starts to get interesting. Enter Haman, the villain. Chapter 3, after all this took place, King Ahasuerus honored Haman the Agagite. Now, you know that Haman is the villain because he's called an Agagite, and the Agagites are the people that are the sworn enemies of Israel and the ones that God has promised to destroy. By the way, fun fact I learned about this story this week. Whenever Orthodox Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim every year, during the season, they do it during the season when this all took place, when they retell the story. And whenever they retell the story, every time they say the name Haman, all the children in the audience respond by hissing and booing. I thought that sounded kind of fun. You wanna try it? Not just the children, but everybody. All right, so when I say Haman, then you gotta boo or hiss. You ready? Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Fantastic. And gave him a higher position than all the other officials. Ahasuerus makes this fool prime minister. Verse 2, the entire royal staff at the king's gate bowed down to him and paid homage to Haman because the king commanded, very good, this to be done for him. Keep it going. But Mordecai would not bow down or pay homage. The members of the royal staff at the king's gate asked Mordecai, again, who was Esther's cousin, why are you disobeying the king's command? By the way, scholars say that this is the central question in the entire book. Who is the real king? Who's really in charge? Who should we really be bowing down to and obeying? Well, the fact that Mordecai won't bow down to Haman. Come on now. The fact that Mordecai won't bow down to Haman, everybody. Okay, you don't have to do it anymore, okay? You got the point. The fact that Mordecai won't bow down to him makes him madder than a three-legged dog trying to bury a bone on a frozen pond. And when Haman finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, he hatches a plan to kill all the Jews. He thinks, you know what? These people are just troublemakers. They've been here long enough. We're just gonna destroy all of them. This is my final solution for them. He presents his plan to Ahasuerus, who evidently has a pretty hands-off approach to governing, and he doesn't really pay attention to what Haman is asking because he's, I don't know, planning his next six-month party, or he's on Twitter calling everybody who disagrees with him nasty names, or whatever it is that the king is doing. Well, chapter 4, Mordecai, who again hangs out around the palace, hears about this plot to kill the Jews, and so he sends an urgent message to his cousin Esther, and he says, Queen Esther, you got to do something about this. And Esther sends a message back to Mordecai saying, verse 11, chapter 4, Cousin Mordecai, I appreciate your concern, but honestly, what can I do? You remember how Ahasuerus responds to women disagreeing with him in public. Don't you remember? He had Queen Vashti banished just for refusing to strut her stuff naked in front of all of his drunk buddies. Imagine what he would do if I, as a woman, had the audacity to confront him and suggest to him that he is making bad government decisions. He would have me killed. You see, Persian law said that if anybody came before the king uninvited, they could be killed. And for this little Jewish girl to appear before Ahasuerus, who is basically the poster child of male chauvinism, and tell him that he doesn't know how to run his government, that would be a death wish. Mordecai's response to her, chapter 4, is timeless, and it is our main text for this weekend. Chapter 4, verse 13, Mordecai says, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews." In other words, Esther, your safety is an illusion. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. In other words, what is certain is that God's will be done, his salvation will be accomplished, and his people will be delivered. The question, Esther, is whether or not you are going to be saved. And who knows, Esther, whether or not you came into the kingdom? Who knows whether or not God put you into this moment at this time for just such a time as this? As we have seen, Esther had not lived a privileged life. And Esther did not really even start out that well in her walk of faith. But this is a defining moment for Esther. And Esther responds with one of the greatest statements of courage in the Bible. Verse 16, "I will therefore go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." And so, chapter 5, on the appointed day, Esther enters into the king's court. And King Ahasuerus, who evidently is still taken in by her beauty, raises his scepter, which was a symbol that she had been accepted by him, and he says to her, "My queen, my beautiful queen, what is it that you need from me? Ask me anything." And she says, "You know, what I'd really like is for you to come to a banquet tomorrow, and I want you to bring your friend Haman with you." Now the king says, okay, that's an odd request, but I'll be happy to do it. And the next night, he and the prime minister come to dinner at Esther's little mini palace. At this first banquet, Esther doesn't mention anything about Haman's genocide plan. Maybe she just doesn't have the courage to do it. Instead, after a night of eating and drinking, she invites them to another banquet the next night because she knows how the king likes to party. Well, meanwhile, Haman goes home from this first party and he's feeling really, really good about himself because of all the people in the kingdom, Esther requested him. And so now he feels like he's part of this, you know, power couple or power triple that's ruling the kingdom. You got the king, you got the queen, and then you got old Haman. And he's thinking, man, who would have thought I'd ever turned out this awesome? And I'm just feeling like I'm awesome and I got awesome sauce dripping from me. And he's just feeling great about himself. But as he's going home, he passes through the city gate. And when he does, Mordecai does that thing that Mordecai does because Mordecai's standing there. Remember how everybody else bows down to Haman and Mordecai doesn't. He's just standing there erect. Everybody's bowing down and he's like making the loser sign on his head as he goes by or whatever. And that just totally kills Haman's buzz. And he decides, you know what? I can't wait until I kill all the Jews to kill this guy. I'm going to kill this guy tomorrow. And so when he gets home, he orders that the palace builders construct a gallows 75 feet high. And they do it that very night. And Haman plans to go to King Ahasuerus the very next morning and ask for permission to hang Mordecai. Well, it just so happens on that very same night that the king back at the palace can't go to sleep. So around 2 o'clock or so in the morning, he says to one of his guards, I can't sleep, go and get me a bedtime story and read it to me. And so this soldier goes to the king's library and chooses a book at random. And the book that he chooses just so happens to be the book that recounts the story of Mordecai saving the king's life. And the king hears the story and says, this is remarkable. How exactly did we reward this fellow Mordecai? And the servant says, well, based on the records here, we didn't reward him at all. So the king decides that he is going to reward Mordecai first thing in the morning. So as soon as the sun rises and the king gets to the office, guess who just so happens to walk into the room? It's Haman, who has come to ask the king for permission to hang Mordecai. But before he can say anything, the king says, hey man, I got a question. Get it? Hey man, I got a question. What should be done for the man that the king wants to honor? Now, remember, Haman is very narcissistic and he thinks that he's just awesome. So he naturally assumes the king's talking about him. And he thinks, oh, this is good. I got a chance to really promote myself. And he says, oh, you should make a really big deal out of this. Well, you need to hang a wreath around his neck and give him a special robe. And you need to have a chariot drive him down the city street. And you need to have a really high-ranking government official run behind the chariot and just call out as he's going by, this is the man whom the king loves. And this is what the king does for the man whom he honors. And King Ahasuerus says, that sounds like a great idea. The guy that I want to honor is named Mordecai. And the guy who should do the shouting is you, which is pretty doggone funny, you got to admit. Well, after this little charade, Haman is now madder than a mosquito in a mannequin factory. So he kicks his plan to kill all the Jews into overdrive, right? And he says, we're going to kill them all. But that night, remember, he's got to go to Esther's second banquet. And this time Esther works up the courage to tell the king about the plot against her people. And she reveals in the process that she also is a Jew. And the king says, who would conceive such a plot against you? And Esther points across the table at Haman, who's got his mouth full of mutton, and says, that's the man right there. Well, now it's Ahasuerus' turn to be angry, and so he storms out of the room in rage, at which point Haman goes over to Esther and grabs a hold of her dress and starts to plead for his life. But apparently, as he is pleading, he falls down on top of her, so now she's on the ground and he's on top of her, and guess who just so happens to walk back in the room at just that moment? King Ahasuerus, who's like, what? Now you're trying to rape my wife also? And he orders Haman to be hung on the next available gallows, which of course just so happens to be the gallows that Haman had constructed the previous night for Mordecai. And so it is that Esther, who got a really rough start in life, saves the Jewish nation. And her courage transformed our lives as well many generations later, because a few generations after this one, one of the descendants of the people that Esther saved that night would be visited by an angel and told that she was pregnant with the Messiah, the Son of God. And Jesus came into the world and died for our sins, and now we sit here worshiping him today because of the courage of an orphan girl who responded in the right way in her defining moment of faith. I believe that Esther's story serves two purposes in the Bible. First is it shows us the remarkable way that God brought Jesus into the world. And secondly, it shows you the way that God wants to use you in his global purposes and how you are supposed to respond to your defining moment of faith. You see, I believe that some of you, and we collectively as a church, I believe we're at a defining moment of faith like Esther. And I'm gonna try to unpack that for you. And I wanna use Esther's story to show you four ways that you are supposed to seize your divine moment of faith. Way number one is you need to realize first that God can use Mordecai's and Esther's. Think of Mordecai's as the kinds of people you normally find in a church. They're good people. They're sincere in their faith. They haven't been involved in really any major scandals. They've got pretty vanilla testimonies. They're boring. They're the worst things they've done in life are speed or forget to recycle or something like that. They tell you their testimony and it puts you to sleep. Esther's, by contrast, are people whose lives are filled with shame or regret, or maybe compromises and mistakes. Maybe like Esther, you've been the victim of somebody else's manipulation. Maybe you have been like her, the victim of assault. Or maybe you look back and see that you have not always acted with courage and faith when you should. What you need to see is that God has a plan for you also. In fact, Esther is the one that God uses to preserve the messianic line. Why? Why is it that of all the people in the Jewish nation, why didn't God choose Mordecai? Why choose an orphan girl who has lived a compromised life of faith? Why choose somebody who is vulnerable in every possible way? It has to be that God is showing us that he brings his salvation into the world through unlikely weak instruments who make themselves available to him. Of all the people in Israel, this is who God chose to bring salvation into the world, a young orphaned immigrant with a checkered past. My point is this, it doesn't matter what your history is. It doesn't matter what your ability is. It only matters what your availability is. God has placed you at a specific place with specific opportunities, with a checkered history for the purposes of his kingdom. And I want you to look around this week and realize that you are in a palace, so to speak. Maybe not a literal palace, but you're in a place where you've got a chance to influence and literally to save the lives of others. And I'll show you what I mean by that in a few minutes. And maybe from this point, you even look backwards and you realize that you got a lot of regrets in life. And maybe you genuinely have been a victim. And maybe you've made a lot of mistakes to get where you are. But the point is you're here now. And it's time to quit looking backwards. And it's time to start looking forwards. Because God wants to start a new thing with you. And he wants to begin today. Esther did not get off to the best start. But in her defining moment, she said yes. She put her yes on the table. And she changed the course of history. That is where some of you are. It is never too late for you to begin the journey of faith. Salvation is all about new beginnings. If any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things are passed away. All things have become new. I know the plans that I have for you, says the Lord. Plans to use you as a blessing, to prosper you, to make you a blessing to others. I have good works that I have preordained that you should go and walk in, and you will never find them as long as you are looking backwards and a prisoner of the past. God has released you from your shame. He has set you free from the victimization that you have experienced from others, and he wants you to walk forward, and he wants you to become a blessing to others. So stop looking backwards and start looking forwards and put your yes on the table and make yourself available to him. Number two, from Esther's story, we see that God's been at work in your life whether you've recognized it or not. He has been at work in your life whether you've recognized it or not. Again, where's the name of God in this book? It's not there. Not a single time. Yet the fingerprints of God are all over this book, are they not? Aren't the fingerprints of God all over this book? Think about all the so-called coincidences that led Esther into being in this position. Queen Vashti just so happens to upset her husband, and he just so happens to come up with a contest to replace her that Esther has been designed and gifted by God to win. And Esther just so happens to be Mordecai's cousin, who just so happens to stumble onto a plot to kill the king. And it just so happens that for some reason, he isn't honored when he saves the king's life, but his act of heroism gets buried in a book. And it just so happens that the night before Mordecai is to be hanged, the king can't sleep, a divinely produced insomnia. And it just so happens that the guy who goes to get a bedtime story out of all the books in the king's library randomly picks the book that records the story of Mordecai saving the king's life. And it just so happens that when the king decides that they need to honor Mordecai first thing in the morning, the first one to walk into the room is Haman. And it just so happens that the banquet where Esther unveils Haman's evil plan, the king just so happens to come back in the moment that he thinks Haman is trying to rape his wife. And it just so happens that when the king orders Haman to be hanged, the only gallows that are available are the ones that Haman built the day before for Mordecai. It's like my friend David Platt says, folks, you can't write a script any better than that. Do you realize what the book of Esther is teaching you about history and about your life? It's teaching you that God has the whole system rigged. He is sovereignly weaving the stories of his people for his redemptive purposes. And that includes your story. You have a divinely appointed role in the kingdom, and you have been sovereignly shaped to fulfill that role. And you will never feel like you have found your purpose or place in life until you start to fulfill that role. You see, think of your palace as the place of opportunity. Think of it as the place that God has placed you. There are people that God has put into your life that he intends for you to share Christ with. It's why he put you where he put you. You're in a certain dorm. You're in a certain dorm room. You're in a certain office complex, a classroom, a neighborhood. You're in a certain cubicle. God has given you certain platforms, and he's given you abilities from which he intends to use you to bless and to serve others. He has given you certain passions that you have acted on, and now you are where you are. You have been given financial resources. We, each of us, has been given financial resources for just such a time as this, to enable this church to reach the triangle and from here to reach the world. God is not calling us because we are able. He's not calling us because we have a perfect history. He just wants us to make ourselves available to him. Summit Church, listen, we're not the most impressive people in the world. We're not the richest. We're not the most talented, but we are here at this moment, and we are sovereignly placed here in the triangle in this moment, and our God has rigged the system to bring the Great Commission to completion in the triangle. And all that God needs to reach the triangle, he has already put in our hands. Already. He's not sitting in heaven saying, well, if we can just get a few more talented and a few more rich people saved. He's already put it here. All he wants us to do is respond to him and say we're available, that we've come into the kingdom for just such a time as this. The question is, have you put your yes on the table yet? By the way, for some of you, you don't even know God. You don't even know God yet. And what you need to realize is that God brought you here this weekend in pursuit of you because he wants to start a relationship with you. See, sometimes when I'm up here preaching, I look around, and as I'm talking, I'll see somebody that I don't really know. And I'll look at them, and I'll just think, like, I wonder why they're here. I wonder what their story is. And for some of you, I know that you're here because God's been speaking to you. And you can see, look in your life, and you can see these moments where God has been, if you look at it, you see that he's been pursuing you. He's put questions in your heart. And then somebody invited you to come to our church. And at first you said no, and you resisted. And finally, you've just consented, and now you're here. Maybe you've been here for several weeks. I don't know. But the point is, you need to understand that you being here is not your idea. Those questions are from God. Those situations are from God. That pain is from God. That invitation that you received is from God. He is in pursuit of you, and he just wants to get your attention. That's it. He's got the whole system rigged. Number three, from Esther's story, we learned that you can't hold on to life, so you might as well risk it for the kingdom. Understandably, Esther demurs when Mordecai urges her to go before the king because she knows that she could die. But then we saw how Mordecai responded, didn't we? Mordecai's like, you might die? Your safety is an illusion, right? We're all gonna die, and you might die in this very moment. Death is certain. What is even more certain is that God's gonna get his work done. God's going to accomplish his purposes. So Esther, if you're gonna go out, you might as well go out doing what is right. Your safety is a myth. You know that at any moment you could get a disastrous phone call from your doctor that could change your life forever. You could walk into work on Monday and be told that you no longer have a job. Safety is an illusion, so it is quite foolish for you to build your life in pursuit of safety, and you might as well bet your life on the one thing you know is going to last. It reminds me of the words of Jim Elliot, who was a missionary to Ecuador, who was martyred in his late 20s. He has a very famous statement, and you've probably heard it before. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. What I cannot keep is my life. I cannot guarantee you that I will wake up tomorrow. I cannot guarantee you I will make it home to hug my wife and my kids another time. But what I cannot lose, what I know I will never lose, is whatever I have staked in God's eternal kingdom. So I will bet my life on that. I have tried to arrange my life according to that one moment I know is going to happen, the one moment I am certain will happen, the one moment that could happen this afternoon. I am going to stand before God, and I'm going to answer as to whether or not I have lived out his purposes for my life and whether I leverage my life and my resources for his kingdom. Y'all, listen, I have read the Bible all the way to the end. I didn't even stop at Revelation 22, the last chapter in the Bible. I read all the way through the concordance. I went all the way through the maps. And here's what is clear. God wins. He writes the epilogue. The only question is whether or not you're going to be part of that epilogue. That is what is certain. And so I am angling the resources of my life toward that end that I know is certain. You see, you and I have an even greater assurance of how all this is going to turn out than Esther did. Here's the greater assurance that we have. Listen, we see in Esther's story a shadow of our coming Savior. I mean, think about it. Esther risked her spot in the palace to intercede for the people of God. This prefigured Jesus, who years later would not only risk the ultimate palace, but lose the ultimate palace, not only risk his life, but actually sacrifice his life in order to save his people, and who now stands before the throne of God, faithfully interceding for us. His resurrection assures us that God is going to win this thing, and God is going to overturn all of the diabolical plans of the world's Hamans for good and overwrite all of the enemy's schemes with victory. It shows us that he is in control and that he has sovereignly rigged the system for the completion of the Great Commission. So why not bet your life on that one thing you know is certain? You see, the point of this book is less about the courage of a man or woman of faith, and it is more about God's sovereign control of history. Who do you think the real king is? Who are you bowing to, and whose service are you in? This same God assures me that one day people from every tribe and tongue are going to be around the throne of God worshiping him. That's Revelation 5. That's how the story ends, and that means anything that I have risked or sacrificed to that end is not wasted. I've told you before how I see the kind of ministry that we do here as a church. This, by the way, my kids say this is their favorite illustration that I use for them, and I'll tell you why. I've told you that our ministry is like, we're like the proverbial woodpecker. Remember this? And we're just the woodpecker that's tapping away at the telephone pole, not making any difference to the telephone pole, just making a little bit of noise. That's all it's doing. When all of a sudden lightning strikes from heaven, that telephone pole splits a thing in two, and the woodpecker's like, you kind of, goes back, and it's looking at this telephone pole that's now split in two, and it flies off and gets several of his buddies, brings them back, and is like, there she is, boys. Look at what I did. And I've told you that that's us, right? That's us because we know the promises of God. We know that God has promised that all people will have a thriving gospel witness before history ends. And so we know that when we are there serving, and we may not be feel like we're doing that much, we may just be given what we have and it feels like it's nothing. We might be continuing to pray. We might be sharing Christ with somebody. But whatever you're doing, you're just da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And all of a sudden, lightning strikes. And we're like, whoa! And then we fly off to all of our friends, and we write a newspaper about it. And then we're like, hey, here, look at what we did. But deep down, we know we didn't do anything. We know that we were just tapping away, and God sent the lightning bolt of his power. And when that happens, we are going to continue to say, I knew it! I knew it! I knew it! I knew God would do what God said God would do, because he promised. And he told us where the thing was going. And I didn't know what was certain in life, but what I knew was certain is that Jesus said, I'll build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And I am glad that every single thing that I invested in his kingdom, I know that none of it has been wasted. And I know that God has multiplied it all for his kingdom. He is not a fool who gives what he can't hold on to anyway to gain access, to put a stake in what he can never lose. I know the question is not whether or not I'm gonna lose my life. I'm gonna lose it somewhere, somehow. The question is, am I going to have a stake in what lasts forever? Many of you have been given great wealth, and in eternity, you are going to lose it all. As the old proverb says, you cannot take any of it with you. So you might as well invest a large chunk of it in the things that last forever. You know, when we started this Multiply journey, I had you list out, all of you, the five things in your life that had the most monetary value. So put them down on a piece of paper. And I said, just look at them and realize that not a one of those five are you going to carry with you into eternity. Not one. So is it maybe that the Spirit of God is telling you to already go ahead and transfer one of those into his kingdom now? Since you can't hold on to it anyway, why not transfer one of those things now? And many of you responded that way. It is recognizing that I can't hold on to it, so why not leverage it and invest it in the kingdom that lasts forever? The kingdom that lasts forever. Lastly, number four, the need is urgent. Esther's story shows us that the need is urgent. Esther stood at the crossroads of a literal life or death moment for Israel. People's lives were on the line. If she did not act, people would die. We also stand at a literal crossroads of life and death for other people. I mean, just consider this. Listen, on average, tomorrow, 60 babies will be aborted in our area tomorrow. Every single day, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25,000 children die from starvation or a preventable disease. There are more slaves around the world today than at any time in history. Most tragically, there are millions of people around us that are going to spend an eternity in hell, and 3.1 billion people around the world have yet to hear the gospel given, explained to them in a way that they can understand. How dare we just sit by? By the way, don't lose the impact of that last one. I talk to college students who often they're moved by the needs of the world. Their heart aches for global suffering, and that's awesome. But the greatest of all suffering is eternal suffering. For some of you, your heart breaks for those who hunger. The greatest hunger is the hunger for the bread of life. You yearn to see people freed from slavery. The greatest slavery is the slavery to sin. Of all the things to give your life to, the gospel is the most important. It's not that we should ever ignore the other things. I mean, they should always go together. When you're preaching peace and salvation to someone's soul, you should also bring peace and prosperity to their body. It's just that we must never forget that the gospel is paramount, that the gospel is the greatest need that the world has, and of all the things to give your life to, you should give it to the spread of the gospel. Esther's life shows us that these are issues of life and death importance. And just like Esther couldn't ignore those life and death realities, Summit Church, I would say, neither can we. Summit Church, Esther's story in the Bible is a great story, but it is also a picture of your life. We are in the same moment as Esther. You are in a divinely orchestrated moment. You have been sovereignly put somewhere by God with certain opportunities and certain resources, and what you do with them has life and death implications for others. We have been placed here for just such a time as this. Now, we have called our moment Multiply as a church. That's where we offer our lives and our resources to God for the spread of the gospel to others. So my challenge to you in this process has been twofold. The first part of the challenge is, if you made a Multiply commitment a couple of years ago, my challenge is to finish strong. Like we saw last weekend, we will only reap the benefit if we persevere. Maybe at the end of this two-year commitment, God's calling you to go farther than you anticipated. That's where my wife and I are. When we put our number down a couple of years ago, we thought, I'm not really sure how we're ever going to make that. But here we are coming up at the end of the 2 years, and we're going to make it. And God has showed us a couple places where we can sacrifice and actually go beyond it. So we're going to be able to have the greatest 2 years of generosity in our life because of some sacrifices that God has enabled us to make, because we realize that God has not blessed us just so we can increase our standard of living. He wants us to leverage our lives for his kingdom and increase our standard of giving. Maybe there's something more, something specific that God is moving in your heart to transfer into his kingdom. Well, for this chapter of Multiply, you've got to the end of the year in order to do that. The second part of the challenge has been, if you're new and if you feel like God is leading you to this church and you feel like, man, I really want to get involved in this church, we want you to join us. We want to invite you to join us. You say, well, how exactly do we join in this process? Just by starting to give. Everything that you give at this church into our offering goes automatically into Multiply. And like I told you last week, if you got questions about it and you're like, well, I want to know kind of where everything goes and all that, if you go to this website here, summitrdu.com/multiply, that'll give you more details. You could ask us whatever question you want. But Multiply is just everything that we give now. It goes into that, and so you can get involved by just giving. As I said last week, Multiply for us is not a two-year journey. It's not a financial campaign. It is a lifestyle of discipleship where we invest what God has given us for the reasons he has given it to us, and that is for the purpose of the spread of his kingdom. Multiply is us saying back to God, God, you put us here in this moment for this purpose with these opportunities and these resources for just such a time as this to bring salvation to our neighbors and to the nations. Check out this fantastic video at all of our campuses of how God is using Multiply and what he has done with it over these last couple of years. What we are going to do tonight, how we are going to respond, I need you to think about this, is going to change the eternities of people in the Triangle and around the world.
Over the past 2 years, we've been on a journey together that we've called Multiply. Multiply began with the conviction that God generously gives us all the things that we have, not just so we enrich our lives, but so we can offer them back to his kingdom. And when we put what we have in God's hands, he multiplies it. The amazing thing is not that God multiplies, but that he chooses us to do it. We've always said that our primary goal with Multiply was not to raise an amount of money, but to see 100% of our people engaged in the mission of God here. God doesn't need our money, he's after our hearts. Multiply has always been about people. Multiply the number of people that can be reached in the Triangle, people sent to live on mission, people who can find freedom and generosity and watch God multiply what they give back to him. Ultimately, it's about seeing lives transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ.
When God had really substantially blessed us, and we in turn felt a call to give, my only drawback about it was, how would our children, who were now of an adult age, feel about this? Because it would impact their inheritance. And then the Holy Spirit spoke to me and said, how could they not be excited over how generous you are?
Basically, you know, before, giving was kind of like an insecure thing. Oh, if I give this much, how am I going to compensate for it? Now it's like you give because you love him. You're no longer insecure. You're no longer afraid what's going to happen tomorrow. So you're fearless.
We're committed to follow Jesus wherever he tells us to go. And that's the joy we find in our lives and want to share that joy. You know, the inconvenience of moving and whatever we deal with of moving will be worth it if we can change one person's life, either because of Winston or hearing our story of us moving our family to go there.
When we have been faithful with the little amount financially or the little amount of time that we have, I think he's multiplied the rest of our lives, and I would consider ourselves richly blessed.
Our secondary goal in Multiply was to give $55 million toward what we believe God is calling us to, here in the Triangle and the world. Our vision as a church is to see the gospel multiply deeper in us and wider in our world. In the lifetime of our church, we've sent 3,153 people on short-term missions trips to the nations, with over 500 of those coming in the last year alone. 228 people are living overseas today, which brings the total number that we've sent out to right at 500. God is using us to spread the gospel to the very ends of the earth. In the last 2 years, we've seen God multiply the summit's influence right here in the Triangle as we've opened the Alamance campus, not just one, but two locations inside our area prisons, launched the Apex campus, and purchased land for both a future North Durham campus and a new broadcast facility in North Raleigh. That means we are now one church that meets in 11 locations each weekend. Two campuses in prisons, one campus in Spanish, but all one church. We've never been and will never be about buildings. We're about reaching people with the gospel, like Wayne and the other five men from the prison campus who were baptized this year, or JR from our Briar Creek campus, who is now making disciples in his workplace, or Aiden, a student who came to Christ at Elevate Summer Camp, or Tulsi, a new sister in Christ who was baptized at Blue Ridge. Multiply began as a two-year journey, but this is just the beginning. This is the moment we say to God, my yes is still on the table and I'm ready for you to put it on the map. God is at work. The need is great. So let's keep giving back to God and watch as he multiplies it for the salvation of the world. There's a lot to celebrate, but the more we see God move, the more we look ahead and ask, what's next?